What do we do about the courts? What do we do about these cases? Like, what's going to happen? I'll tell you what you should do. You should hump your ass in a time machine and listen to me 4 years ago. That was your opportunity, right? I said that Merrick Garland had about a year to bring Trump to trial. You have a year to bring him to trial because he's going to do all these delaying tactics. You have a year to bring him to trial so that you can hopefully have the trial within 3 years so that he can be a convicted, jailed person before he's allowed to run for president, or else he will run for president again. And then who knows what the hell happens.
Yep.
But Merrick Garland didn't do that.
He did not. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Well, we are a week and some days out from the November 5th presidential election, in which the world reoriented itself, where Republicans clean sweep and really kind of reset the table for American culture, economics, life, national security. And so there's a lot to understand. There's a lot to sort of get ourselves wrapped around. And I gave a lot of thought to who should be the person to help us do that. And my friend Ellie Mistel is the one who came to mind. He is the nation's justice correspondent. You know him from his time and work at MSNBC. You know him from his writings, the clarity of his thought, the precise nature of which he lays out an argument, and the energy and the force of nature that he is. He's also the Alfred Nobler Fellow at the Type Media Center. His latest book is the New York Times bestseller, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. Ellie will join us and sort of break down what happened and what lies ahead for us as we reemerge into the land of Trump. Coming up right after this on the Michael Steele Podcast. So now it's been a week. How you feeling? Are you a certain way yet still? Yeah, we're watching the Trump administration come into better focus with the selection of a chief of staff and Susie Wiles, noise about particular cabinet members who are going to rule the roost, as they say. And to help us kind of process this and continue sort of the cathartic sessions that I know many of us have been having is a buddy of mine. I'm so excited to have you on, Ellie. I just really am, man. It's just really good to have you here because we were talking before and I was following you leading into election night, and it's you know, you want to go to smart people who kind of understand the moment and kind of have figured out what to look for versus what not to get caught on and to get caught up in. And there were very few people who did that because it was the immediate emotional reaction, very very similar to 2016, where people just kind of like, oh my God, I thought she was going to win. But you came to a very clarifying moment rather quickly in the evening in terms of how this was going to play out. Share with us your thinking then a little bit, and then now, a week out or so from events, and we have a not clear, absolute clear view of where this administration is going to be going, because I think they told us a lot of that ahead of time. But what are you anticipating from what you're seeing?
Well, there are two vectors that have to kind of exist in my head at the same time, right? And the first vector is personal, right? The first and most important thing that I'm looking out for is threats to my safety.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I'm absolutely terrified. And I don't, and we can talk about putting aside for the moment the fear of state-sponsored violence against me and people who look like me, which is something that I do believe is going to happen, but putting that aside for the moment, One thing that I think people have to understand is that writ large at a macro level, Trump is a violent person. Many of his supporters, not all, are violent people. And Trump's election is a vindication for that violence.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And the way that personally affects me is that I'm a target. I got this big ass afro. I get on TV, right? I'm exactly the kind of guy that one of these people can take a shot at, and in the worst case scenario, miss and hit somebody that I love, right? That is a real threat. It's always a real threat for any like public person, whatever, but it is a realer threat now than it was 2 weeks ago because he won and he tells them that what they are and their truly worst based impulses are okay. Michael, if you look back at, you know, our mass shootings that we have regularly in this country still,
right,
in so many cases, when the mass shooter is white and they're shooting up a club of Hispanics or a club or a church of black people, they expect that the police are on their side. And that's before this election, right? They expect that the police are going to support them because they did something about the great menace that they've been told exists. What do you think they're going to expect now?
Well, that's particularly true when you hear policemen out there saying, sign me up for the mass deportations.
So Vector One is just the rando MAGA people, armed MAGA people who not only might be out to do me harm, but like feel empowered and emboldened to do that harm. Number two is absolutely, as you say, the police. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of police officers and law enforcement officials who voted for a convicted felon over a prosecutor. Now, maybe they were concerned about inflation. Maybe.
Maybe.
But maybe not, Michael.
Maybe not. That. Maybe not. Maybe
and
not.
And how do I get to know which one they are?
Right.
When I'm driving past them in my car, right? How do I get to know that it's only the economically aggrieved police officers that are patrolling my black ass in my town? I don't get to know that.
Yeah,
right? You don't. And so there's the violence coming from police officers who, again, remember, Trump has specifically said that he wants to give police officers the kind of absolute immunity that the Supreme Court gave Trump.
Yep.
What is a world in which police have truly no accountability coming from the very top of this country? It's not a safe one for me and my community. It's not a safe one for me and my people, right? And so those are the things that I'm worried about most before we even get into the fact that some of the most violent, vindictive people you can think of are now going to be in charge of the Justice Department, are now going to be in charge of the FBI, right? So I was talking to one friend of ours that has appeared with us on these shows and these TVs, and she was like, well, at the very least, I expect to be audited, right? Like, that's like the low-hanging fruit is that you expect I hope it's the IRS knocking at my door as opposed to the FBI.
Exactly.
So just Vector One is just that the thing that you're looking for is that personal kind of like, am I safe? Am I safe to do what I do? As a, you know, I was a critic of the Trump administration the first time. I was a critic of the Biden administration. If anybody had been listening to me back then, I would have been a critic of the Obama administration. I was a critic of the Bush administration. Like, I'm a critic. I criticize things. Am I free to do that now?
Right.
And at what cost? At what, you know, what level of danger do I invite by
doing? I think that's you raise a very interesting and I think important question from a number of perspectives relative to a free press, and I put that in quotation marks, relative to protest, because criticism is a form of protest. Critiquing is a form of protest. And so when that starts to happen, how the administration responds writ large, how Trump responds personally, will be a very important tell of where things go. I took note of the fact that there are protests that are planned 2 days before the inauguration as opposed to 2 days after the inauguration.
Right. I have also noted, for instance, that many of these pro-Palestinian protesters, who I agree with on many scales, felt really comfortable interrupting Kamala Harris every 2 seconds she threw out a word out of her mouth, but right. haven't said boo at a Trump rally in a very long time, right?
Yeah.
So I also am eager to see if you bring that same energy and heat and smoke on January 21st as you might be willing to bring on January 18th, right? And right. if you don't, what does that mean?
I tell you what it means. I tell you exactly what it means. It is exactly what it meant to Jeff Bezos. It's exactly what it meant to the LA Times. That I don't want to create a lane where ire and disruption and anger from Donald Trump comes towards me. And I, for the life of me, have still been puzzled by that sense of fear. So, yeah. So what happens when he starts to target individuals like you, myself, Cheney's, others with audits and investigations? What does the country say? That's okay, because guess what? Inflation's coming down. Well, inflation's been coming down for the past year. You didn't seem to want to give Joe Biden credit for that. When it's now at 2.1%, where a year ago was at 9.1%, you didn't want to give him credit for that. You didn't want to give him credit for the booming stock market. And yet here we are, and you're now going to transfer all of that love and credit to the incoming administration, because here's where I kind of get off the lane with everybody else, because at the end of the day, this is what you wanted to begin with.
Yep.
That you're okay. You're okay. I get it. There are people out there who are going through economic hardships, that the rising tide didn't lift their boat. Understood that. And that's always been a problem with some of our economic modeling. And particularly the way administrations respond coming out of a crisis. But at the end of the day, Ellie, you still have the misogyny, the racism, the xenophobia, the anger, the hatred, the vintage narratives around the longing, the sweet talking Nazism, the all of those things. And then there was Madison Square Garden, where they just full throatedly, outwardly just said, here we are. And the American people looked at that and said, okay.
It's a trade-off they're willing to make. And it's something that I've been struggling a little bit with post the re-election, right? Because you have so many pundits, analysts, whatever, saying, oh, see, this is what happens when you call half of America racist. They reject you. They didn't reject you because they're not racist. They didn't reject you because they're not misogynist. They don't like it when you tell them that's what they are.
Right.
I agree with that, you know?
Right.
I don't like it when people call me fat. That doesn't mean that I'm hitting the gym. Right? That's not how I skin that cat, right? So I concede the point, right? To use a lawyerly term, I stipulate that racist, misogynist people do not like being called racist and misogynist people. Fine, we agree about that. But what these people have decided is that either their racism and misogyny trumps all objective knowledge and fact, or, and I think this is more poignant, and this is more to the point, they decided that it doesn't matter, right? They decided that's a willing trade-off. Whatever dollar off grocery bill they want to get, whatever, you know, 250 gas as opposed to 289 gas they want to happen, they've decided that the racism and misogyny is a willing price, is a price they're willing to pay to right. get whatever things they want. And I think largely because they don't think that the racism and misogyny is coming for them, they think that it's coming for me, and they're not wrong. So when it does come for me or you or Joy Reid or Liz Cheney yeah. or Rachel Maddow, what are they going to say? They're going to say good. Yeah. They're going to say those people deserve it. I don't deserve it. Those people deserve it. That's what they're going to say, because that's what they actually believe.
That's what they believe.
And so that's something that we have to, I think, deal with. And I think that that then brings me into the second part of the conversation of what's the actual lesson here for the opposition party, the Democratic.
Well, hold that, because you set me up perfectly to tag into your great piece at The Nation. I want to get to that second part, because that's essentially the rest of the story in so many respects. But you wrote, I thought, look, folks, I'm just telling you, you cannot look at what Ellie's writing in this piece through a progressive lens. He's a progressive. I'm a conservative. Ellie and I could go all day long about tax policy and go have a beer, right? That's not this fight. This is about the roots of this country and how the roots of the nation are starting to rot. You know, America deserves everything it is about to get. We had a chance to stand united against fascism, authoritarianism, racism, and bigotry, but we did not. We had a chance to create a better world for not just ourselves, but our sisters and brothers in at least some of the communities most vulnerable to unchecked white rule, but we did not. We had a chance to pass down a better, safer, cleaner world to our children, but we did not. Instead, we chose Trump, J.D. Vance, and a few white Southern African billionaires who know a thing or two about instituting apartheid. But it got better. You go on, to be clear. I mean, there's so much. To be clear, America did this. America, through the process of a free and fair election, demanded this. America as an idea, concept, and institution wanted this. And America as a collective deserves to get what it wants. And there's a whole lot of stuff between that and this final point. Trump is not our retribution. He is our reckoning.
Yep. The point of that, right? And I think I put it well, if I do say so.
No, bro, you know. Look, and see, and I'm glad you say that, because when people read it, you cannot read this, oh, well, he's a progressive and this is just, you know, liberal bullshit. No, the brother's telling you something that's profoundly important to understand about the roots of what we witnessed, the roots of the vote, the roots of the outcome. And so I give it back to you, sir.
But I will give it back to you, because I now remember the brilliant thing you said on election night. The thing that really got me out of my chair, and like, that man gets it. You said America will always tell you what she wants. You said that, Michael, right? You said America will always tell you what she wants, right?
Yep.
And she just did. America just told you clearly
what she wants.
What she wants. And she wants Trump. She wants this, right? And so we deserve it. So a huge thing that we have to kind of reckon with is giving them what they want. Because for too long, we've tried for too long. We, and by we, I don't just mean the Democratic Party. I mean the intellectual elite of this country, of which I am a proud member. I certainly paid a lot for it. Right? For too long, we have said, America is better than this. America is better than Trump. Come on, guys. It's the Joe Biden line, right? Come on, guys. Come on. No, Joe, we're not. We're not better. We're not better than this. We are this. And we can never get better than this if we don't confront who we are, if we don't confront what we are, if we don't confront why we want the things that we want, right? Because that is the first step to recovery, right? You don't get over being a drug addict by saying, I don't got no problem. No. You get over being a drug addict by hitting rock bottom and admitting that you have a problem that needs to be addressed. Trump is not the cause of any of this. America is the cause of Trump, not the other way around. And we have to deal with that, right? And I particularly noted what you said on TV, because you were like the only one who did, or one of the only people who kind of got that aspect of it, that this was, you know, this was a demand from this country to have him reinstalled. That's why it's like, to me, so different than 2016, not just because like 2016 shock, oh my God, what happened, right? I always used to joke that in 2016, the people who were most surprised were educated black people like us,
Right.
Because we were like, Chad would never do that, man. Right? Like the people in the hood, the people didn't have the opportunities that you and I have had. They knew. You know, it's that Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock sketch. Black people knew what white people were capable of. As brothers like us, we're like, oh my God, no way, Matthew Higginbotham the third. No way, man. That ain't this. That was 2016. That ain't now. America knew exactly what it was voting for now. Yeah. And the Americans that stayed home, they knew also exactly what they were staying home about.
And the beauty of that, those folks, this is my interpretation, could be wrong, but I doubt it, was that it was almost like Pontius Pilate.
Right? Right? I wash my hands of your demolition.
There you go. I'm like, no, you can't blame me. I wrote somebody's name in, or I didn't even bother to go to the polls. When you look at the number of people, both candidates underperformed their 2020 election vote.
Although I will say, just really quickly, part of that is not just COVID, but part of that is that it was easier to vote in 2020. Part of why the votes were suppressed was because after 2020, a bunch of states were like, we're going to make it totally harder to vote. And again, at some point, we will get into the Democratic Party's complicity in all of this. But like, you know, it's one of the reasons why both candidates underperformed, is because it was literally harder to vote this time. But I mean, look, at core, this is what the country asked for. And now, I think the real question is that we have to live with it. People get the government they deserve. That's not me. That's Thomas Jefferson. Right. Yep. And I know that a lot of people who didn't vote for him, a lot of people who worked hard against them. Even since I wrote that article, I've gotten a lot of, you know, feedback, pushback from people who worked very hard against them, being like, well, I didn't want this. I did everything that I could. And at an individual level, nobody deserves it. Right. I am a crazy liberal, which means that at an individual level, I don't even think the Trump people deserve it individually. The people who voted for their own deportation do not deserve to be deported. They will be. They will be. I'm not saying they deserve it, right? Nobody deserves to die because of the way they voted, right? But as a country, as a nation, as a people, we deserve every bit of what Trump's about to bring to us.
Yeah, I was sitting there watching, we did some interviews on MSNBC with members of this particular family where I think the father is here illegally. His wife is legal, children obviously illegal, they were born here. And so the question was, well, are you concerned about being deported or you know, rallied, you know, pulled up and out of your home? And they were like, oh, no, they're only going to do that to criminals. Right. And I was sitting there going, well, you know, if that is here illegally, that's a crime.
they think it only happens to bad people, right?
Right.
It reminds me of, so this is a really dated reference, but in my defense, I was real small when I saw this the first time, right? I have since seen it again, but there's an old Twilight Zone episode where the man brings a button, it's a kind of old 1950s house, brings a button covered by a dome into the house, right?
All right.
And the guy says, if you push this button, something terrible will happen to somebody you don't know, but we'll give you $1 million, right? We'll change your life, right? And so the family, the whole episode is like, whether or not the family pushes the button. And near the end of the episode, I think it's the wife like rips open the, you know, cover, pushes the button, money falls, you know, gets $1 million. And then the guy comes back and takes the button away. And they're like, well, where are you taking the button? And he goes, to somebody you don't know. Like, they always think somebody they don't know is somebody else. They play the string all the way out to the end and realize the somebody they don't know is them.
Yeah.
And that is profoundly important. And that is what is about to happen to a lot of these people, a lot of the people who voted for him, a lot of the people who didn't vote at all. And unfortunately, a lot of the people who voted against them.
Yeah,
a lot of people tried to stop it. And so one of the things, and I want to actually ask you a question.
Sure.
Field. about whether or not you're seeing this, because what I am seeing in my community, in my Black communities, in my Black network, is it's a very different conversation that I'm having in my Black networks versus my white networks. It just is.
It just right is, now. Yeah.
And the difference of vitriol and betrayal that I'm hearing in my Black networks, especially from Black women, is real. Right. There's a real, I'm hearing a real sense of like, these people have stabbed us in the back for the last time. I'm not lifting a finger again. I'm not helping them again. And people need to understand that, like, people don't generally understand how much the Democratic Party is reliant upon the volunteer labor of Black women at an operational level. Mm-hmm. And a literal, like, when the Democratic Party is talking about putting boots on the ground, the boots are heels. And the people on the ground are Black women, right? Yeah. They are the aunts and grandmothers who are actually stuffing the mail in the envelopes, right?
Yeah.
And licking the stamps and doing the door-to-door kind of work. And if those women are like, screw this, you're talking about taking out the Democratic Party's base of operation at its knees. And I have never seen Black women, Black people generally, but Black women specifically, react to an election loss quite like this, because the feeling of betrayal.
Well, that's why.
From the white women, obviously, from the Latino community, the feeling of betrayal is so very real. I don't know how quickly or easily you're
it's not. It's not. The Democrats have a real problem on their hands. And it's multifaceted. It is along ideological lines with this progressive wing, which now which I've talked to some progressives who feel that they did not pursue the right kind of policies to really animate. It's not, you know, it's not the Gaza stuff. It's more, again, economic conversations that to the extent that there were certain policies that were produced by the administration, they weren't protected by the administration. So, for example, the student loan program was just left to rot on the vine and be, you know, it's like you take the body and you throw it out in the desert and you wonder why the buzzards are eating it. Well, it's because you threw the body in the desert. So you have this real sense out there of the Democratic Party confronting a potential implosion around what you're saying, where that base is all of those coalitions, all the coalitions that were created to form what we know as the Democratic Party are now in their own lanes, and some are starting to drive away. And that's going to be a real problem. There are a lot of conservatives who are gleeful for that, because what they think is that sets them up in 28 and beyond to hold that line with a fractured Democratic Party. And as one put it to me the other night, everyone thought that our party would be the one to blow up and it'll be the Democrats. And I looked at them and said, oh, dude, our party blew up in 2010, 12, 11. We've been dead for a while. This is a zombie walking here. This MAGA is zombie land. Don't think you got something here that's, you know, sustainable. I said, when the Democrats ever get their act together, it's a different ballgame for you. But you make the right point about that aspect of all of this with Black women. Like you, I've had a lot of hot conversations, a lot of anger over this, particularly given that yet again, as one sister put it to me, we've been screwed by white women. 53% of white women, given everything they know about this man, from grabbing by the pussy to, you know, taking away their reproductive health, stood in line and pulled the lever for that. And so there is that. That's where a lot of that betrayal kind of centers. You look at the energy for Kamala coming out of the gate. It was Black women that jump started that whole thing with that Zoom call of 400,000 women. Raising $5-6 million, and it didn't seem to matter. And then, of course, you know, as I put it, She had to run a flawless campaign, jumping over every hoop, explaining herself, her blackness, her womanhood to every white man and every white news agency on the planet, while Donald Trump basically sat there visually in a diaper, drooling, spewing bullshit, and no one seemed to care. And now here we are, and folks want to look at them and said that they should have done more.
Yeah, it's really not flying in my networks. Nobody wants to hear that. You know, you say it's not the Gaza thing. People have noticed that while this was a stunning Trump victory across the board in Michigan, where the Palestinian vote was most loudly withheld, y'all notice that pro-Israeli Jewish senator, Democratic senator Elise Slotkin, she hung on to her seat, but Harris lost, right? Pro-Israeli Senator Ruben Gallego, he won his seat, but Harris lost Arizona by a lot, right? So like you see all of these incongruencies all over the place, and it really makes it pretty clear that Harris's first problem was her biggest problem. She was a woman. She was a black woman. And that was just not something that white women or Latino men were going to vote for. I will note, just not to, I will note that all this talk about
that, get ready, folks. Men,
not some, that didn't seem to happen now, did it? That didn't seems like black men actually showed up again and voted for the black lady. I'm just saying that the media, we spent like half a summer talking about like, what is that man going to do in the barbershop? And we were on our job. We were on our job like we always are. I just wanted to point that out in case people hadn't seen that particular exit poll, right? But look, I mean, this is the look. I'm doing it. And I try not to, like, I'm devolving into the blame game, and like that's not helpful. It's not constructive. I'm only pointing it out because it becomes a real issue if the people who did the work, if the people who put in the work, feel abandoned and betrayed by the rest of the coalition. Democrats cannot exist as currently constituted without coalition politics. And I fear that this final Trump reelection has driven a serious wedge and done serious damage to the Democratic coalition that Democrats rely on to get elected. And that goes to your point. Trump has killed most likely both parties.
Yeah.
Right? He killed the Republicans long ago. And as you say, like, people who think that he didn't kill the Republicans are falling for the okie doke. It's a different party. They got the same name, right?
But a different party.
But you know, I'm a Met fan. Before one of the playoff games, they had the Temptations play for the Mets, open the game for the Mets. It wasn't the real Temptations because they all dead, but it's the group that has the name The Temptations, right?
Yeah.
And that's the Republican Party, right? They are still the Republican Party, but it ain't anything to do
right.
with the party of Reagan other than the name. Democrats are most likely about to go through a similar internal revolution. So whatever comes out might still be called the Democratic Party, but it ain't going to have crap to do with Bill Clinton, or it ain't going to have crap to do with FDR. Or something like, you know what I'm saying? But it's not going to be, it's not going to be the way it was. That Obama coalition, let me put it like that. The Obama coalition, that's dead.
That's dead.
Trump killed that.
Yeah. Effectively killed that. We're talking with Eli Nistel. He is one of my fave peeps out there. He is just one of the, you wouldn't believe this guy's a lawyer. His social commentary is as powerful as his legal mind. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Eli, I want to get into a little bit more what you're talking about, what the landscape looks like politically, what it may look like from a policy standpoint, and as well, the fact that there are a whole lot of lawsuits and, I mean, lawsuits, criminal cases that are just going to disappear. they gone. They go.
Goodbye.
More with Eli Nistel right after this. Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. I'm glad you could be with us. We've got Eli in the house. So, Eli, before I went to break, we were talking about Trump effectively having killed not one but both parties. Yes, the Republican Party is still a party in name only, but it is MAGA. It is has the infection of MAGA coursing through its veins. It is no longer the party of Reagan, Eisenhower, Bush, et cetera. Democrats facing the same reality. How they deal with that will be important. The indication so far is probably not that well. But, you know, there's always hope because y'all seem to do a lot of hoping on your side. to be quite honest, y'all hope a lot. So hopefully it'll work. But the rest of the landscape in front of us is one in which you have a new administration that's coming in that has already started to make clear its intention to summarily deport individuals, to deconstruct the federal government into Donald Trump's image, to put sycophants and loyalists in very powerful positions to the point that they've already indicated they do not want to use the FBI background check process, but rather prefer to freely associate, if you will. If Trump wants somebody, just bring him in and give him the job without the fact of a criminal background check, a conflicts check, et cetera. What does that tell you we should be looking for and expecting from a second Trump administration?
Yeah, so I got to take this in kind of first principles, right? Democrats spent 2 years, really 4 years, but certainly in the last 2 years, telling this country that Trump was a unique and existential threat to democratic self-government. Now, we know from the election that most people didn't buy it. Most people do not think that Trump is a unique threat to democracy, right?
Right.
Turns out, based on a lot of the conversations I've heard over the past few weeks, Democrats don't think that either. Because if you are sitting here running about talking about 2026, talking about 2028, talking about, is it going to be Andy Beshear or Gavin Newsom in 2020? That means you think that we're going to have a regular election in 2028.
Yeah.
And if you think we're going to have a regular election in 2028, just like all the ones before, then guess what? Trump wasn't an existential threat. He was just an asshole. Probably shouldn't have told people for 2 years that he was an existential threat if y'all even don't believe it, right? Now, right. I happen to believe it. I don't necessarily think we're going to have a normal, free, and fair election in 2028. Right. I think there's a great chance it's going to be one of these banana republic elections where J.D. Vance or whoever the Trump successor is, and the fight for the Trump successor will be bloody and awful on their side. But whoever grabs the Trump ring, and I'm only assuming that Trump's leaving, not because of the 22nd Amendment.
I'm on the record now. I don't think he leaves because Trump's thinking of, I didn't have two back-to-back terms.
Yeah, I don't think he leaves. I think that Father Time is undefeated. So right. So it's either Trump or Vance. But I'm saying I think we have an election where like Vance wins 89% of the vote. One of those banana republic elections. I don't think it's a real election. But if you do. If you're a Democrat and you think that we're going to have a real election in 2026 and a real election in 2028, well, then you lied to the people for 2 years, and that's why they didn't believe you, right? So that's kind of macro level when we talk about what we expect from Trump. I expect that he will start the process of dismantling the ability for the opposition party to run in opposition to him. That's what I expect. Now, if I am wrong about that, and all he does is the normal Trumpian, the normalized Trumpian things, well, then it's a different question, right? Because then it turns out he was not an existential threat to the principles of democratic self-government. It turns out he was an existential threat to elite democratic institutions. And that is a different thing.
That's a different thing.
This is the piece that I'm working on now for sometime next week, right? That's a different thing. If we think that Trump is not going to destroy the structures of democracy, but simply destroy the institutions that uphold the establishment of democracy, our established way, we're going to destroy the administrative state. We're going to destroy all of these executive agencies. We're going to destroy all of these elite bastions of power like universities and colleges, right? If that's what he's going to destroy, that is very bad, but Democrats have to respond to that. Democrats will have difficulty responding to that because a lot of people want those institutions destroyed. That is part of what we were talking about earlier. That is part of what America is telling you, people.
Right.
that we don't like these elite institutions, that we don't trust these elite institutions. And if Democrats run a candidate that is literally the defender of the establishment institutions, they will lose again.
So there are three areas that I'm going to draw to our attention for this conversation. National security, you know, sort of auditing, sort of the truth, the fact that government lies to us, and of course, the bureaucracy. Let's take a quick listen to the man in his own words talking about moving bureaucracy.
Federal bureaucracy to new locations outside the Washington swamp. Just as I moved the Bureau of Land Management to Colorado, as many as 100,000 government positions could be moved out, and I mean immediately, of Washington to places filled with patriots who love America, and they really do love America. Ninth, I will work to ban federal bureaucrats from taking jobs at the companies they deal with and that they regulate. So they deal with these companies and they regulate these companies and then they want to take jobs from these companies. Doesn't work that way. Such a public display cannot go on, and it's taking place all the time, like with Big Pharma. Finally, I will push a constitutional amendment to oppose term limits on members of Congress. This is how I will shatter the deep state and restore government that is controlled by the people and for the people. Thank you very much.
So his plan is to kind of just let's break the government down and just push it out into the country. So, okay, A, they're already there. Their agencies are already spread out across the country. B, this idea that you're going to have a constitutional amendment to oppose term limits. Dude, do you know how long it takes to run a constitutional amendment through the United States Congress and get the 338 states that you're going to need to approve that? So this idea, impose,
right? He's imposing term limits, right?
Yeah, that's right. He wants to shatter these and restore
right.
government.
He's going to so make, that, you know, Congress people can only serve for 2-3 terms, right? That's
right, right. So this idea sort of breaking down government to its barest bones is, I think, works into your narrative about whether or not this is something that is an existential threat that we all should be concerned about, or something that plays to our, yeah, we really do need to blow that shit up.
Everything he just said, Michael, is popular. Everything he just said is popular.
Yeah.
I'll do you one better. Everything he just said, I basically agree with. Like, right? A true draining of the swamp, a true like breaking of the DC cordon, as you point out, Michael, he's dumb. He doesn't realize that a lot of that is already takes place. But
right.
if you're going to tell me that you're going to move some of these federal agencies out of Washington so they aren't constantly sucking at the teat of lobbyists and congresspeople, I'm not opposed to that. That doesn't sound like an inherently bad thing to me. If you're going to talk about imposing term limits on Congress, I'm not opposed to that. That doesn't sound like an inherently bad thing to me. I would love to get some of these, like, I don't even know, octogenarians, 100-year-old people out of that's okay with me. And then the third thing was what was it? It was opposing the term limits, draining the swamp of the bureaucrats. Oh, and stopping the bureaucrat to regulatory pipeline.
Right.
That was an Obama idea. I really like that one. Obama tried to do that, right? It's his, I don't know what Trump's rich friends are going to think about that. But yeah, I do not think that you should be able to go from an SEC regulator to working at Citibank to back to the SEC to working at Deutsche Bank. I don't think that's a good idea. We should totally do that, right? So everything he just said is popular, and everything he just said, lots of people, even on my side of the aisle, agree with. So if the counter to that from the Democrats is no, we must protect the bureaucrats, we're going to lose again.
You're going to lose that argument.
Right. And then, but then here's the problem, right? I want to, it's like from Lord of the Rings, right? I want to use the Ring of Power for good, Michael. But you want to use it for bad. Like, yeah.
right.
Basically saying, right, because he wants to do these things to cripple the ability of government to function. So he is going to lead with the things that are obviously popular, like he just did, term limits, draining the swamp, right? Those are popular things. But underneath, the things that are not in his speech are all of the Project 2025 stuff of completely reforming the federal government so that there are no bureaucrats, there are no experts, there are just loyalists that report directly to Trump and increasingly directly to Musk, directly to Thiel, directly to Vance. With the one hand, he is offering you
exactly
what you want. But with the hand behind his back, he's breaking the ability for the government to function. That's the problem. But that problem isn't in his speech. And the Democrats don't have a great answer for why what he just said is bad.
So what about Musk? I've likened Musk to every Bond villain rolled into one person.
So, dumb Tony Stark.
And Tony Stark got on my nerves quite a bit, if I'm truthful.
It's not just Musk. It's Musk, it's Peter Thiel, it's David Sacks. These are three white South Africans. And I point that out, and I know that white people don't necessarily like it when I point that out, but I point that out is that these are not three post Nelson Mandela, playing rugby with Matt Damon white South Africans.
No.
These are three white South Africans who got their start, who have the base of their fortune was based in apartheid South Africa. The apartheid South Africa being the worst version of apartheid that the world saw in the modern centuries, right?
Yeah.
So what do we do with that information? Now, a lot of white people are like, nothing, it doesn't matter. How dare you even bring it up? That's racist. No.
Why are you talking about that?
Because apartheid wasn't a moral failure, wasn't just a moral failure. It was a system. It was a system of government to permanently oppress a larger racial population. As white folks looked ahead toward the demographic future, where they are rapidly becoming a minority. As you think, this is what the great replacement theory, that's what they're all afraid of. That's why they want to force white women to have children and all. They're so worried that they're going to be outnumbered. As you look to a white population that is going to be outnumbered, the system of apartheid becomes very appealing to the soon-to-be minority rulers of the country. And so when we talk about Musk, I don't think of him first as tech bro and all that.
No.
I don't think of him first as billionaire and what all that means. I don't think of him first in the way that either, a New York Times tech reporter would think of him. I don't think of him first in the way that, frankly, AOC or Bernie Sanders would think of him. I think of him first as a white South African and what that means.
Yep.
Right. And second as a white South African with incredible money, with incredible power, when now finally with incredible access to the structures of government. And that is what I am far more afraid of than him giving himself some more tax breaks. I mean, you saw his stock went up, X billion dollars after Trump. I'm not the hoarding of his wealth, the wealth that he hoards, the wealth that he and his friends hoard, is a macroeconomic problem, and I'm not dismissing that, but that's not the first vector of threat with these people. And so I'm much more concerned about him with actual power, not to give himself money,
right,
but to permanently oppress a whole racial population of people. And Thiel's just like him, and Sachs is just like him.
What is your take on the court cases you had? I figured before I let you go, I'd give you something to laugh over.
I got a lot of texts, obviously, about what do we do about the courts? What do we do about these cases? Like, what's going to happen? And I said to one, I'll tell you what you should do. You should huff your ass in a time machine and listen to me 4 years ago. That was your opportunity, right? I said 4 years ago, I said from the jump, I said that Merrick Garland had about a year to bring Trump to trial. That there was that people were telling me how long it takes to do the investigation. I was like, you're telling me how much time you want. I'm telling you how much time you have. You have a year to bring him to trial because he's going to do all these delaying tactics. You have a year to bring him to trial so that you can hopefully have the trial within 3 years so that he can be a convicted, jailed person before he's allowed to run for president, or else he will run for president again. And then who knows what the hell happens.
Yep.
But Merrick Garland didn't do that.
He did not.
Joe Biden's biggest mistake. I like to say Merrick Garland was the worst appointee in two consecutive Democratic administrations because the worst person Obama could have appointed to fill Antonin Scalia's seat. And now he's the worst person that Joe Biden could have appointed to be the AG. He failed the moment. And so now as Jack Smith runs, you know, wraps up the prosecutions, what the hell do you expect Smith to do? Trump got away with it, folks.
He did. He did.
Got away with it. The Supreme Court said he got away with it. He got away with it. There is no more there.
Nope.
People are saying Smith should just, I don't know what they think he should do, but I'm going to tell you, if he does anything else other than what he's doing, which is winding down his case, the only person that's going to go to jail is Smith.
Right.
Not Trump. That's just reality. If Smith, look, I like to say, Jack Smith, don't know the man. But, you know, this is a man that's prosecuted war criminals. And if you do that kind of work, you know when the getting's good.
Yeah.
Like you know when you got to get your ass out of somebody's country.
Yeah.
As well. And that's all I see from Smith. Smith knows the jig, as it were, is up. Of course, he's shutting it down. Right? He has no choice. Trump got away with it. We had one chance to bring him to justice, and Merrick Garland failed. I wrote in March 2023.
I remember.
You
were the only person at that time who raised that flag. And as that year got closer and closer to its end, was saying more vociferously, y'all, Merrick Garland is screwing this up.
In March 2023, I was like, he already screwed it up. I was like, in March 2023, I was like, the time for holding Trump accountable has already passed. And everything that's happened since March, which is the Jack Smith investigation and the lawsuit and
right.
the Fannie Will, like everything that's happened since then has been for show, has been a lot of shouting. There was never a chance that he was going to be brought to justice. And now he clearly is not, because he's not only has all the powers of the presidency, can dissolve any argument or prosecution against him, can pardon himself or his friends or anybody who might testify as a witness against them. He also has absolute immunity for official acts from the Supreme Court. No, Trump got away with it. It's Merrick Garland's fault, and the other person's fault is Mitch McConnell, right? Because Mitch McConnell had the chance after January 6th with the impeachment trial. He had a chance to end it right there. I like to say that, to continue the Lord of the Rings analogies, Mitch McConnell is a Sildor, right? He had the one chance to throw the ring away, and he's like, no.
Right?
Mitch McConnell said, Trump is still legally responsible for everything. And Mitch McConnell was wrong, right? Yeah. Trump was not legally to be accountable for anything once Mitch McConnell let him off the hook and once Merrick Garland got that job. That's just over. That's just done. And the idea that there's anything left to do is pie in the, you talked about hopium from my side of the aisle. It is pie in the sky folly. He got away with it, and he will die in his own bed, a peaceful man.
Ellie Missel, I tell you, brother, I just enjoy you so much. I love your writing. I love your commentary. It's clarifying and precise. I love it when you get agitated because it gets me fired up. And I'm glad you could take the time to come on, man, and sort of give us a week or so out from all that's happened, some clarifying understanding of what happened and what we should be looking at coming down the road, because we ain't in Kansas anymore, folks.
Michael, right? Michael, honestly, just from my house to yours, stay safe, man.
Yeah. Amen to that.
Stay safe.
Folks, thank you guys for joining us and being a part of this conversation. It's always a treat when Ellie's in the house. We've had him on a few barbershops over the years. And as you can see, we really confuse the barber when we show up because the barber don't know what to do. I love it when he's in the chair and I love it when he's on. Thank you so much. Follow Ellie on Twitter, X at Ellie NYC. Check out his work at The Nation, and certainly do pay attention because brother's not going to steer you wrong. He's not steering you wrong. He's giving you stuff to think about in this moment. Until next time, folks, you know what you need to do. Share, view this podcast. We love it when you do that download thing. I'm so glad you can be with us here on the Bulwark Online Network. Until next time, be safe, be well, take care, God bless.